We hope you find this WILL podcast to be valuable. A $10 voluntary credit card contribution at willpledge.org will help us continue to make podcasts of our programs available. Thank you. And that address again is willpledge.org. WILLPLEDGE.ORG. Now here's your program.
This is the Afternoon Magazine on AM 580 and FM 90.9 HD2, online at willillinois.edu. I'm Celeste Quinn. Glad you could be with us today. Licensed registered dietitian Susan Kundrat is with me in the studio this afternoon. She joins us once a month, usually on the first Monday of the month, to talk about diet and nutrition. If you have a question for Susan, give us a call. The number in the Champaign-Urbana area is 333-9455. That's 333-WILL. Anywhere else, call toll-free 800-222-9455, 800-222-WILL. Susan Kundrat is a sports and wellness nutritionist and president of Nutrition on the Move. She works with clients of all ages and athletes on enhancing health, fitness, and sports performance. She's an adjunct lecturer with the University of Illinois Food Science and Human Nutrition Department. She's also the consulting sports dietitian for Illini Athletics and leads nutrition and cooking classes at the ARC, that's the Activities and Recreation Center, on the Urbana-Champaign campus of the University of Illinois. She's a member of the American Dietetic Association and the American College of Sports Medicine. She's the author of 101 Sports Nutrition Tips. Questions about diet, nutrition, they are invited this afternoon. Again, those phone numbers, 333-9455 and toll-free, 800-222-9455, 333-WILL, 800-222-WILL. Good afternoon. Good to see you.
Good
Welcome
see
back.
You.
So this is November already, and it is Diabetes Awareness Month.
Yes, it is.
And you suggested maybe what we could do is talk a little bit about making better choices around the holidays and
right.
celebrating the special occasions, but yet, you know, being able to partake but not going overboard.
Exactly. And one of the things I think we just need to kind of put out there is that for many people, whether they have diabetes and are monitoring their blood sugars or heart disease or high cholesterol, I think it can be a stressful time for people if, you know, they think about so many things that are revolving around food. And really in our culture, so much of it now from really the next few weeks on until after the New Year's really revolves around parties and food and maybe family get-togethers and trying to manage that. So for a lot of the clients I work with, having a strategy is really helpful. And going into that and knowing that you're going to have the things you really love and maybe being aware of portions. And also, what can you do to plan ahead to make sure there are plenty of options that you can eat so that you are satisfied and full and feeling good with what you're eating, but not necessarily going overboard, whether
yeah.
it's monitoring a carbohydrate or what that might be.
And as hosts, we can also provide people with some sensible options
yes.
at parties and dinners and the like.
Right. I mean, one simple thing we can do if we're hosting a party is just be mindful to have a really nice vegetable tray. Because if you think about things like cauliflower and broccoli and cherry tomatoes and carrots and fresh green beans or asparagus or things like that, they're so low in carbohydrate generally that someone could come and really enjoy partaking in that and feel like they're getting enough to eat. Because I think that's really a key is feeling like you can go and you're still monitoring portions a bit, but you can also eat along with everybody else because that's really a part of it. So just that simple thing of maybe having a fresh vegetable tray. And then the other thing that people can think of if they're hosting a party or hosting a dinner is consider having two or three vegetable options that aren't creamed or don't have a lot of sauces on them that would be just steamed. So, for example, maybe you've got steamed asparagus but also have a salad. And if you have something like sweet potatoes, we'll consider making baked sweet potatoes, or have a recipe in here that's, you know, a sweet potato recipe that's not as high in sugar. And that way you've got some options for people. But just the idea of bumping up the vegetables if you're going to have a meal. Then if somebody has diabetes, they can come in and know that, boy, there are a lot of options that aren't going to count much towards their carbohydrate intake.
Yeah. You brought with you today some diabetes-friendly holiday recipes, and these sound like, you know, the real deal.
The real deal, that's right.
And we can share these with our listeners if they want to send us drop us a note, and we'll send this out to them. And also it's going to be in the Strawberry Fields newsletter.
Right, it'll be in the newsletter this month.
Okay, so for example, here we've got roasted pear and butternut squash soup, twice-baked sweet potato with mini marshmallow topping. That, mm-hmm. you know, how do you make that? Is it portions that we're talking about here, Susan, or have you tweaked the recipe?
Well, it's both. It's portions, because in this recipe, we could kind of talk about that, the twice-baked sweet potatoes. There are four medium sweet potatoes, and of course, sometimes people with diabetes stay away from sweet potatoes because they are a little higher in natural sugar, but they're also high in fiber and a good source of other key nutrients like vitamin A, and so they're really good. It would be just the matter of, you know, how much you take in. But this calls for four medium sweet potatoes, quarter teaspoon salt, teaspoon allspice, a third a cup low-fat buttermilk. Buttermilk generally is very low-fat. 4 tablespoons of Greek plain yogurt. So you can get plain non-fat yogurt to add some of that creaminess. And then just a half cup of miniature marshmallows. So if you look at that, you think, well, it's not as sweet. There's not as much sugar mm-hmm. that's added to that. After the sweet potatoes are baked, you put that in the food processor, puree it with the salt and the allspice, add the buttermilk, and then you add the yogurt, processing it until smooth. So it's a bit creamy. It's more mm-hmm. of a creamy sweet potato. And then you add the marshmallows just on top a little bit. So what you get is even a little bit more protein in there from the yogurt, which is good, and a creamier sweet potato, but not as sweet. So it's still, you know, it's still something that would be good, but it'd be a way to modify a recipe of something that we typically have. I certainly grew up having the big, thick marshmallows on top, which I still like, but you know, this would be something that
offers you a taste, but
right, yeah. Not quite as high in
sugar.
Not
overboard. Mm-hmm. You mentioned now a couple of times since we've been talking fiber.
Mm-hmm.
Why is that important in controlling weight and in controlling diabetes?
Mm-hmm. Well, fiber, which is generally we think of it as the undigestible part of food. So if you're eating something and that food gets broken down, and there's certain parts of that food that are not going to get digested but just go through the system for, you know, forming bulk in the stool, that's a really helpful thing to have in your diet with diabetes, because we know that more fiber tends to slow down the digestion of food in the system. So that kind of slows down the rise in blood sugar. That's good. We also know that fiber overall, if you have more fiber in your diet, it tends to make you feel more full. And so maybe we don't eat as much or as many calories. And when we think about diabetes, we always also think about high cholesterol, or we think about heart disease, because having diabetes is also a risk factor for heart disease and vice versa. So we want to say, well, are there things that we can eat that maybe keep the lipids down as well or help modulate that? And fiber is very important for lipid management too, so meaning cholesterol management or monitoring your high cholesterol. So adding foods that may be naturally sweet but high in fiber can be really helpful. And one of the other recipes here that we have is roasted pear and butternut squash soup. So I love squash soup in the fall, and that's a great thing to have. And pears tend to be one of the fruits that is about the highest in soluble fiber, or this gummy fiber that we think is important for blood sugar regulation. So this recipe calls for 2 pears, 2 pounds butternut squash, or you could use any squash you wanted, 2 tomatoes, a leek, 2 cloves garlic, pepper, low-sodium vegetable broth, which is very easy to find now, a tablespoon of fresh chives. And so what you do is combine the pears, the squash, tomatoes, leeks, garlic, and the oil in a bowl, toss to coat the ingredients, and you just roast that on a baking sheet, for about 40 to 55 minutes at 400 degrees, and you let those cool, puree half of those with the broth, repeating with the other half, and then you go ahead and add that in and cook it over medium heat. And so it's basically roasted vegetables and the roasted pears as well, and then cooked together and made into a soup, creamed together. So I find this time of year it's really helpful to either have a food processor. I've seen several of them in the ads lately for sale, or you know, for on sale at places. Have either a food processor, or what I use a lot this time of year too is just the hand blender,
a stick blender.
Yeah, those are great because you can certainly then just add a little bit of broth to your vegetables and blend that up. And this is a great recipe because per a cup of this soup, it's only 130 calories or so, but it's actually 7 grams of fiber. And it's 31 grams of carbohydrate. Generally, if someone is watching their carbohydrate, if they're diabetic, they're looking at a serving of carbs as about 15 grams. And so this would fit right in. You'd basically have a serving of fruit and a serving of vegetable in there, but it wouldn't be too high in carbohydrate. And then you're getting the additional fiber, which is great. And this isn't that difficult to do. I think sometimes we stay away from these soups that look so fancy, but really when you're just coating the vegetables and fruit, if you have it, and roasting them and then bringing them back out and mixing them up, it's not that difficult to do. Even in a blender, a lot of times you can use a blender to go ahead and mix the broth with the vegetables.
Well, so one of the things you're doing here is by roasting the fruit and the vegetables is you are bumping up the flavor.
Right.
And then by processing them, you get a creamy puree, and you don't need cream or milk. You have this low-sodium vegetable broth in there instead.
Exactly. And that works really well. I think any kind of soup that you might make yourself where you could take half of that and go ahead and blend that up really does make a creamy soup. I made a soup the other day that was very simple, and it was just what you might consider to be a basic bean soup. I just made cooked up an onion and a couple cups of celery and a couple cups of carrots with some olive oil and some garlic and just got that soft. And then added in, I think it was just 3 cups of, again, the low-sodium vegetable broth and cooked that up, but took out a cup of that, of the broth, and just mixed that with a can of cannellini beans. So you just rinse the beans, mix that with the broth in a blender, a hand blender I used, pour that back in with another can of cannellini beans and another can of black beans, and then what you have is just a real nice vegetable and bean soup, and then at the very end you add 6 cups of fresh chopped kale. And that soup sounds so healthy, and it tastes so good for being such a healthy soup, and add a few spices in there. And that's another way that you just, you take about, you've got about 2 cups that you add in that's blended, so it really makes a nice cream to that soup. And I know we've talked about kale a lot on this show, and that's another way that the kale just cooked down maybe for 10 minutes, that's about it, and it was nice and soft. And that would be something that if someone's diabetic too, and if you're having a party or having things, adding items, maybe a bean dip instead of a higher fat vegetable dip, because the beans, again, are high in fiber, a good protein source. They're not just carbohydrate, and it's not going to be as high in fat, but a soup that would include vegetables and beans. And really the bottom line, again, for these calories, looking at trying to monitor your calories is bumping up those vegetables. So that's a big help.
This is the Afternoon Magazine. Our guest this afternoon, licensed registered dietitian Susan Kundrat of Nutrition on the Move. Listeners, if you'd like to join us this afternoon, if you've got a question, a comment, 333-9455 is the number in the Champaign-Urbana area. That's 333-WILL, toll-free 800-222-9455, 800-222-9455. What can people who are at risk for type 2 diabetes do to prevent or delay the onset?
Well, there are a couple things that are probably most important. One is being active. And I think about it as if when you are exercising, again, it doesn't have to be hard exercise, but every time you even walk 15 minutes or walk 20 minutes, you're basically burning sugar in your body. That's what we're doing. Now, if we don't have diabetes, generally our blood sugar is just going to stay within a normal range and still going to burn sugar, but it's not necessarily going to change a lot. But for someone who might have some high blood sugars or be insulin resistant or maybe not diagnosed with type 2 diabetes yet, but kind of be on their way, then that may bring their blood sugar down 20 or 30 or 40 milligrams, which could really make a big difference. And so one thing would be just trying to be active two or three times a day, even if it's short bursts of activity, because that tells your body you're generating heat, you've got to burn something, and your body's going to be burning that blood sugar so that you hopefully don't keep it as high for as long a period of time. So that's one thing. And the second thing is to just really spread out your food. And so we know that the body has a real difficult time if it's difficult to process the food, or particularly process the carbohydrate. If you have a whole lot at one time, then blood sugars can really spike, and that can be difficult. That can be damaging to the body and damaging to the arteries. And so trying to spread out your food and not eat too big of meals, that's really helpful. Now, coming into the holidays, that's a little bit tricky, because we do want to make sure that we're enjoying the meal, and often they're very big meals. And so it might be that we, even as hosts, we try to say, well, we're not going to have as much right at the meal, but when you come, we're going to have a bit of an appetizer, and that might be a little bigger than we'd normally do. Then the meal itself is not going to be as large. That would be a very easy thing to do that would help someone who may have some high blood sugars, so they're not eating so much at one time.
Yeah, and either before or after, we're going to take a walk.
That's exactly right.
Around to the park.
Yes, yes, that makes a big difference, because that is medicine. I mean, we say exercise is medicine, and it truly, truly is for someone, particularly with diabetes or someone who does have heart disease or high cholesterol, because we do know that the body responds favorably to walking, to exercise, to any kind of activity. Maybe you plan a Wii Fit, game that you're playing.
Okay.
I can remember last year we were over at families in Peoria, and the family that hosted the Thanksgiving meal had a Wii Fit or a Wii tennis tournament. And so we were all downstairs playing tennis against one another after the meal. And that was a great idea, because it was, maybe we weren't going to be outside, but we were still active and got everybody involved. And so thinking along those terms of how can you get the activity up, I think is really helpful.
This is the Afternoon Magazine. My name is Celeste Quinn. Our guest this afternoon, Susan Kundrat. She's a sports and wellness nutritionist. She works with clients of all ages and athletes on enhancing health, fitness, and sports performance. She's the consulting sports dietitian for Alani Athletics and leads nutrition and cooking classes at the ARC, that's the Activities and Recreation Center, on the Urbana-Champaign campus of the University of Illinois. My name is Celeste Quinn, and I invite your questions this afternoon for Susan, 333-9455, the number in the Champaign-Urbana area, toll-free 800-222-9455, 333-WILL, 800-222-WILL. One of the things I read in the paper this weekend that was kind of surprising, although the journalist seemed not too surprised by this, was a rising rate of obesity and diabetes in the country. The obesity rate climbed more than one percentage point in September from a year earlier to 26.4%. What does that tell you as a dietitian about where we are?
Well, really our goal nationally, when we look at our national guidelines and our healthy people guidelines that come out periodically, is to try to keep dropping that down, preferably down to, any way to get that down to, 20% or something. So we're going the wrong direction. So that is disheartening. I think we do have to look at how easy it is to eat. I mean, for many people, how easy it is. Not everybody has enough food, obviously, but it is very simple for people to eat no matter where they are. And I think just personally, you're driving, you're in the car, maybe we stop and get some gas, but we get something to eat, because that's typically what we do now. And just everywhere we are, it's so easy to take in extra calories. So one of the big pushes right now is to help people understand how much are they really eating. Over at the ARC with the wellness program over there, one thing that we've started to offer is just a free diet analysis to people. So if they wanted to come in and just write down what they're eating on our forms, and my student interns are analyzing those, and we're, taking a look just to help people recognize, well, what are you taking in? Not necessarily to make recommended changes right then, but just as a way to look at that. So I think many of us don't realize the calories in certain foods. We might not realize the calories in what we're drinking, as well as eating, and just looking at also the activity and trying to just figure out where that balance is, because it is very easy to overeat as opposed to, you know, taking in about the amount that we require to maintain. And, of course, we do know that metabolism does slow down as we get older. We know that certainly if we don't maintain as much lean muscle mass, then we tend to gain weight more easily. And so that's where this whole push towards getting people to stay active and maybe do some more exercise as they get older is very important.
Let's take a call now. A listener in Urbana is waiting for us on line one. Hello.
Hello.
Hi.
Yeah, I just want to know her position on performance gels regarding running, you know, like in races, pre-race and the time prior to, the overall effectiveness regarding, for example, hammer gel and so forth. I just want to know her position on those. And I'll hang up and listen. Thank you.
Okay. Thanks for the call.
Yes. Thanks for that call. If we think about the gels, and for people who aren't familiar with this, the gels are just concentrated, generally mostly carbohydrate packets that endurance athletes will use that usually have around 100 calories, sometimes a little bit more, of mostly quick carbohydrate. And so they can be extremely helpful when you're, especially when you're going an hour or more, because we know we're probably going to benefit from having some additional carbohydrate during exercise during that time. So the first thing I'd say about gels is that make sure you try different kinds during your training and as close as you can to training that might mimic an actual race. So, for example, make sure if you're using them during training, you actually use them during a long run on Sunday, if that's your long run day. So you can make sure that, first of all, it doesn't bother your stomach. Some gels, because they're formulated a little bit differently, they have a little different percentage of certain types of sugars in them, might give somebody some stomach distress or, you know, cause some problems there. So you just want to practice with them. A good guideline, there's no necessary need to have it before you actually train if you've eaten well leading up to that. You certainly could take in an extra gel beforehand with water, but you don't necessarily have to beforehand. But what I would do during is what we're really shooting for, if you're going an hour longer, is a minimum of 30 grams of carbohydrate per hour. Most of the studies during endurance running, endurance cycling, indicate 30 to 60 grams of carbohydrate per hour of competition or per hour of heavy training is optimal for most people. Now, again, there might be some people who can tolerate more than that, but when we think of 30 grams of carbohydrate, that's going to be close to a gel pack. And so in your mind, you might think, okay, I probably need to take in 1 to 2 gels per hour of heavy running if I'm running a marathon or if I'm going to be going 3 hours or however long that might be, you know, probably a minimum of 1 gel per hour. And that's how you can use it when you practice with it. The other thing that I've found certainly is when I've got runners who might be, you know, higher weight runners, male runners typically, or you know, endurance athletes who might be 170, 180, 190 pounds, depending upon what your weight is, you know, you may go to that higher end of carbohydrate. In other words, 2 gel packs during the hour might be better for you because you're actually burning so many more calories than a 110-pound runner who might be fine with 1 gel. The other thing, whenever you're using gels, we have a recommendation of trying to get in at least 8 ounces of fluid around the gel. In other words, don't just have the gel and not have fluid, because then that really could cause a stomach problem, or you're not going to digest it as well if you don't have the fluid. So you might think you have 4 ounces of water, then you have your gel the next 10 or 15 minutes and with another 4 ounces of water, and try to make sure you're hydrated during so it doesn't bother your stomach. But they can be extremely helpful because they're portable, they're easy to squeeze, they're easy to use. And the biggest thing I do is try to just encourage, whether it's hammer gel or whatever, power gel or whatever product you like, that you try different ones so you know what works for you. Also be mindful that a lot of the gels have caffeine in them now too. Many of them have 100 or 200 milligrams of caffeine, which you might really like. It might really help you when you're running. But for some people who aren't used to using much caffeine or don't like it, sometimes it makes them jittery while they run. So make sure you try them with or without caffeine, depending upon what you think you want to do. But they can be extremely helpful. And I certainly have runners I work with, too, who do the gels and do the sport drinks because they feel like that extra bit of carbohydrate is really helpful.
So if you're not going to do that, though, you mentioned diet. Are there foods that you recommend to your endurance athletes ahead of their activity or following or in the midst?
Yes. Well, what you want before you actually race is you want foods that you're used to again, foods that work for you on your stomach, foods that you know make you feel good and are somewhat satisfying for you. And depending upon the time of the race, of course, we usually try to get 2 to 3 hours before the race to have time for that meal to digest or partially digest at least. So if a race typically might be at, you know, 9 in the morning or something like that, you probably want to make sure by 7 your breakfast is pretty well taken care of. And that's what you typically do again on your long race days. You want to mimic what you do on your long run days, excuse me, your long training days, so that your body's very used to that. So foods that tend to work really well are things like, you know, oatmeal with peanut butter mixed in and maybe a banana and some extra fluids, maybe some extra juice. Or for someone who doesn't like that much on their stomach to get protein and carbs mixed, you might have yogurt with some cereal in your yogurt and a glass of juice. That might be enough on your stomach. And so everybody's really individual with what they can tolerate, but you don't want just carbohydrate. In other words, sometimes I'll have some athletes who get up, have a quick granola bar and water, and then they train for 2 hours. It's really not enough energy for pre-workout or pre-race. So you'd want to say, well, have
it's
that granola bar.
It's not enough energy for anything.
No, it's not enough energy. And so, and I think sometimes endurance runners in particular, or endurance athletes, do tend to get kind of nervous about eating much beforehand because, you know, when you're running 2 hours and you don't really want to have to stop and go to the bathroom much, you have to make sure that what you take in is not too much on your stomach, but it's
just
enough
right
energy.
Mm-hmm.
And so I would just encourage the listener to try different things to see what works. But definitely this whole idea of 30 to 60 grams of carbohydrate for every hour that you're running hard, most athletes will actually train better and they'll actually perform better with that. So the gel is an easy portable way to get that.
Now that we're in the cooler weather, what about the need for fluid for athletes? I would imagine it's not as high as it would be at the height of summer, mm-hmm. but I would also imagine that you do have to keep that in mind no matter what time of year you're working out, running,
right,
whatever you're doing.
Right. What I would suggest is to keep your pre-workout hydration plan pretty much the same all year round. In other words, what I tell the athletes at Illinois here is to make sure when you get up again, you have a big water bottle and you try to drink that within the first hour. Then you have another one in class and you kind of pre-hydrate so that whatever time your practice is, you can have your regular fluids with meals and things, but you've made up for the fluid that you lose while you sleep. So I wouldn't change that at all, no matter what time of year it is, because you still want to go into workouts really well hydrated. What you may find is that, you know, during practices, you may be okay with the minimum intake. Again, you might, you know, have a cup of water or a cup of sport drink or whatever you have, you know, every 20 minutes or 30 minutes or whenever you get a break, and you might find that, oh, that's enough. I don't need 2 cups every time I take a break, or I don't need to take a break as much because you're prehydrated and you might not be sweating as much if you're outside and it's cool. But to remember that many athletes train inside, practice inside, and so they're probably going to be as hot or sweat just as much as they would typically other times during the year. So you really have to be mindful of that. You know, the only way to really tell if you're drinking enough is to periodically weigh yourself before a hard practice, get an idea with your normal drinking during that day and normal eating, weigh yourself before, and then weigh yourself after before you take in anything else and see how much weight you've lost. And you want to keep that to 2% of your body weight. So, for example, if you're a 200-pound athlete and you find that you've lost, 4 pounds in a workout, well, that might be okay. That might not hamper performance. But if you can maybe drink a little more, that'd be better. But you really want to keep it to that 2% of body weight loss. And we find that most athletes, if they lose that or much more than that, it's probably going to hamper their training. And so they're just not going to train at the level that they normally could. The other thing I think to keep in mind, if somebody's a heavy sweater, they're probably going to be a heavy sweater in the winter and a heavy sweater in the summer. And occasionally we'll have athletes who are out running outside and they bundle up so well that actually they sweat more because they've got too much clothes on. So that's something to keep in mind, too.
This is the Afternoon Magazine. Susan Kundrot is with us this afternoon. She's a licensed registered dietitian. She joins us once a month, usually on the first Monday of the month, to talk about diet and nutrition. My name is Celeste Quinn. Listeners, I encourage you to join us this afternoon with questions, comments. The number in the Champaign-Urbana area, 333-9455. That's 333-WILL. We also have a toll-free number. That number is 800-222-9455, 800-222-WILL. Questions about diet and nutrition are invited this afternoon. You mentioned spreading food out across the day, you know, not sitting down to great big meals. How do we do that? What does that look like in terms of portion control?
Mm-hmm. Well, a way to think about that is, let's say, for example, middle-aged person might require 1,500 to 2,000 calories. So let's say on the low end, let's say you're trying to either manage your weight or maybe cut down a little bit in terms of your weight, and you're eating 1,500 calories during the day. That might be pretty typical. And so if we take those 1,500 calories, a good thing to do is to take those 1,500 and say, well, let's divide them out so that from breakfast to lunch, you're getting about 500. From lunch to dinner, you're getting about 500. And from dinner on, you're getting about 500. So if you spread it out that way, it's real easy to see that maybe a typical breakfast of a bowl of cereal for someone is maybe not enough early, because again, you want to eat a little bit more at that time, or have a morning snack of maybe some nuts and dried fruit or something. Lunch might be typically 500 calories, but dinners are often 1,000 calories or more. And so the place where we need to kind of move some of those calories would probably be, if you're 1,500 calories that you're taking in, would be from dinner. So your evening meal, you'd say, if you have a typical portion of what we'd look at a plate, this whole idea of this quarter portion, mm-hmm. you have 3 or 4 ounces of protein or meat, you have a cup of pasta, you have a cup of steamed vegetables, and maybe a little bit of fruit with your meal, that's easily 500 calories. And so you want to make sure your dinner meal is just not too big and not too heavy on the starch either, because it's fine to have pasta and rice and peas and corn and all those starchy vegetables, but you really want smaller portions of those at night, because it's much better to have your protein, more vegetables and salads like broccoli and cauliflower and green mm-hmm. beans and those types of things that are low in carbohydrate, a little bit of starch. And then maybe you do have a glass of milk or something to drink with that. So that meal, typically most of my clients need to lean that meal out to spread out these calories. They need to say, well, my dinner is going to be really my protein, a lot of vegetables, a little bit of pasta or starch. And then if I have a little dessert, I'll try to make it something that's a single portion size. That's really important at night, I think, having a frozen fruit bar or a little fudge bar or a sugar-free bar or something like that that would be a reasonable portion, or a 100-calorie pack or something. Because at night, it's very easy for us to sit down and eat extra calories and be hungry and think, oh, gosh, what am I going to go eat now? And before you know it, you might eat 2,000 calories from dinner on. And that typically is when we tend to overeat.
Is the body better at processing smaller
yes.
meals? You know, maybe not three meals, but three meals and two snacks.
Mm-hmm. Right. The body is best at that because, again, it's not so much energy to handle at once. Right. And it's generally easier for the digestive system, too, if you don't have a huge amount of food at one time. We know that smaller portion meals, the body can tend to digest those a little bit better because there's not so much in the stomach at one time. And that's helpful. We also know that if you eat too much at one time, again, particularly if you might be prone to diabetes, and the question you had earlier was very good in that we know there are many, many millions of Americans who are probably pre-diabetic or have high blood sugars and maybe not diagnosed yet, or maybe they, so many times I'll work with clients who find out they're diabetic when they went to the hospital for something else and their blood sugars were so high, but they really didn't know. They didn't feel very great, but they didn't realize that they had diabetes or a problem with that. And so now we realize that for most people who might be a little overweight, who might be more sedentary, they certainly could be at risk for type 2 diabetes. And, of course, we've seen that a lot with younger and younger population as well. And so I think that any way we can look at saying, can you monitor the amount that you eat at a meal? And a simple thing to do there is just say, well, if I'm going to have a snack, I'll throw in a fruit too.
Mm-hmm.
Because then it fills you up. So if you have a bag of chips and you're eating all those chips, well, you're not going to eat as many chips if you have a big old bowl of baby carrots with them, too, because there's just physically you're not going to eat that much. And so that drops down the calories because, you can only eat so much at one time in terms of the amount. But it is physiologically easier for the body, that's for sure, to have smaller amounts at a time. And then we certainly have studies on people who are active and athletes finding that if they eat several times a day and they're active, they're much more apt to maintain their muscle mass. And even in some older populations where people are not necessarily training hard, but they're active, and we have a real concern now about trying to prevent sarcopenia or the loss of muscle mass as we get older. And so we know that eating several times a day, making sure there's protein every time you eat, can be helpful mm-hmm. in maintaining muscle mass as we age.
When you work with folks, how long does it take to get into the groove, so to speak, to get into that proper place where they should be, make it a routine.
Mm-hmm. Well, sometimes it can take several months to actually get things in place. The real goal is to try to do a few things at a time. And so I'll give you an example. For some of my clients, the thing we work on first is eating breakfast consistently, because certainly many people just don't eat breakfast. They're in a hurry, or they don't like it, or they're not used to it, or never prioritized it. So just doing that one simple thing where you get up and you start getting fuel, well, most people are going to feel so much better, have so much more energy, and that's a good thing to start first, because you get positive feedback from that and say, gosh, once I get that in order, that doesn't really take too much to do. And then maybe after 3 or 4 weeks of that, we can start saying, okay, how about lunches? Are you bringing your lunch now? Are you not? What are you doing? A friend of mine I was talking to the other day has a new job, and she's trying to cut down, and she's lost some weight. She's done a great job. And so we were talking about lunch, and she said, well, I'm driving home and having my lunch at home and then driving back, because she has a good, you know, hour for lunch. And I said, how about 2 or 3 days a week bringing a real simple lunch? I'll give you ideas so that you could just cook it up there, microwave it at work, and then you've got a half an hour to walk. Because, boy, and that seemed reasonable to her, maybe a few times a week. And so what a difference that would make for someone, just that you're not in the car for a half an hour driving back and forth for lunch, but you're actually there where you can just eat and then walk. And so I think gradually adding those things, I try to go through the day. What can we do early? What can we do around lunchtime? What can you do at dinner? But it's not unusual for many people, when they're busy and they have all these other things going on in their lives, to take a few months to really implement the changes. And it's just like exercise, because for many people, they might come to me for the diet part, but we really got to get the exercise going too. So I may refer them to a personal trainer or to someone who can really help them with a structured exercise program. And having both of those things in place at once can really be helpful. But often people do well by starting one first and then the other, not feeling like they have to make every change at once.
Yeah, very good. This is the Afternoon Magazine. Susan Kundrat is with us today. She joins us once a month, usually on the first Monday of the month, to talk about diet and nutrition. My name is Celeste Quinn. Listeners, I encourage you to give us a call this afternoon with questions, comments for Susan. 333-9455, the number in the Champaign-Urbana area. Toll-free 800-222-9455. We've got about 7 or 8 minutes left in this portion of the program. I noticed that you're turning to something here. Was there something you wanted to mention?
Yeah.
You've got some materials here with you in the studio.
I've got a few just ideas for recipes, or a few recipes I wanted to go over too, because what we haven't talked a lot about is sweets. And of course, people with diabetes need sweets too. We all need to have some, you know, some good sweets that we can count on. And so I have a couple recipes here that are good and not that high in sugar, not that high in carbohydrate. One of them is, for the holidays, a cheesecake. It's an old-style creamy cheesecake. And this is the recipe of different books actually put out by Splenda. So Splenda puts out, you know, different recipes using their sugar substitute. And this cheesecake actually calls for just making your graham cracker crust yourself by smashing the graham crackers and just putting them on the bottom. But then it calls for a cup of the Splenda granular sugar, 2 tablespoons reduced calorie margarine, 3 8-ounce packages of fat-free cream cheese. So fat-free cream cheese is one of those things that works pretty well in recipes. And boy, does that cut down the calories when you use the fat-free or low-fat version. Has cornstarch, non-fat dry milk powder, vanilla, you would imagine, and eggs. And so it's a really nice recipe, and a lot of these are on the Splenda website too. But the good thing about this recipe, when I look at the calories, it's 213 calories and 29 grams of carbohydrate. So that would be 2 carbohydrate servings. And so someone might say, well, I'm going to eat my meal. I'm going to go heavy on the veggies, maybe a little bit of starch, but I know I'm going to have dessert, so I won't have an extra roll, or I won't have 2 servings of potatoes. I'll cut those down, knowing that I'm going to have some dessert. And this type of recipe is nice because the other thing we know for blood sugar control that's helpful is to have protein with even if you had this dessert after the meal and not with your meal, it'd be okay. It's not just sugar. It's got 13 grams of protein, which is 2 ounces, and because of the fat-free cream cheese. So it's a great recipe. And again, that would be, you know, easy to find on that Splenda website. Another one that one of my students, Sarah, had put together with these other recipes for November, is a pumpkin pie recipe. And it's just making a basic pumpkin pie without as much sugar in it, and using small ginger snap cookies for the bottom, for the crust, and just smashing those up. and using that, and has some evaporated skim milk, some eggs, and the bit of sweetener in there is raisins.
Oh, interesting.
So that's okay. Kind of the sweetener. And same thing, 30 grams of carbohydrate per serving, which is a very reasonable serving in terms of carbs.
Let's take some calls now. Next, we go to a listener in Urbana on line one. Hello.
Hello.
Hi.
Hi. I'm a largely vegetarian person, above 65, and to supplement for my proteins, I add some rice protein to my breakfast, about a tablespoon. I'm wondering if there is an immunological advantage in switching to a whey protein, and if so, what type of protein should I be considering?
Mm-hmm. Well, the bottom line for protein is getting enough. And when you're vegetarian, we know that your needs are a little bit higher. There's some controversy right now on certainly the amount of protein someone needs. And as we get older, do we need more protein? That's the big question, because there's a lot of studies looking at that, again, with trying to preserve muscle mass and decrease risk of injuries and those kinds of things. So probably at a minimum, you'd take your body weight and divide it in half. You know, if you weigh 160 pounds, that'd be 80 grams of protein that you'd want to take in. Knowing that when your protein sources are primarily vegetarian, they may not be quite as high biological value protein, quite as high, quite as good of protein sources, but we got to make sure we get them in. You asked about, like a powdered protein, a whey protein, if you were interested in using that. I will say that a lot of the studies looking at protein, the type of protein that's beneficial for maintaining muscle and being helpful, they've looked at whey and they've looked at soy primarily. Those have been the two. And casein, which is another milk protein. I'm most familiar with the whey protein because I've helped with some of the education that's come out from the whey protein group. But certainly the research on whey protein is very positive. And so that's an easy protein. You can find it anywhere in a powdered form. Or if you just like to drink milk, then you can get whey and casein protein both by drinking a little bit more milk, if you do add that into your diet. So that can be helpful. Or even using some soy milk if you wanted to add that in for extra protein. So the rice protein is a good protein, but because it is completely vegetarian protein, it's not going to have all the amino acids that you're going to find in whey protein.
Okay,
and so
thank you.
That would be the benefit, yeah.
Next, we take a call from a listener in Chicago. Line 4, hi.
Thank you. We've heard the benefits of cinnamon as being beneficial for those with diabetes. Can you comment? Is it still given credibility and if we employ cinnamon?
Yes, there certainly have been some studies on cinnamon, and I think there will be more and more on different herbs and spices and how they can benefit us. But the studies that have come out on cinnamon generally have looked at a quarter teaspoon of cinnamon 2 times a day. That may be helpful for blood sugar. It might be helpful for cholesterol or blood pressure. And again, these are early studies, so I would say we definitely need more studies. But I don't see any downside to using cinnamon. And it'd be easy because you could add cinnamon in the morning to oatmeal or cream of wheat, or many people just add it into their yogurt in the morning.
I'm mentioning your pumpkin pie recipe a while ago that there, I understand, and the glycemic index, pumpkin is way over 100 in terms of its standing in the glycemic index. So that pumpkin pie is going to be delicious, but for a diabetic, it could be kind of a over-the-wall type of thing to indulge in. But thank you for the good work you're doing. Thank you very much.
Mm-hmm, thank you. Well, and I think that brings up a good point. The glycemic index, or what we typically look at now is glycemic load, you know, that really refers to how does your body process these sugars? Are some sugars going to be turned into sugar more quickly, blood sugar more quickly or more slowly in the body? And that is something we take into consideration. But primarily, we're also looking at total amount of carbohydrate, total amount of sugar. Because we used to say, and way back when I became a dietitian, we'd say, oh, gosh, you know, if you're diabetic, you better not eat any sugar and you better not eat any sweets. And we got to watch all this stuff. And we're still mindful of that. But we know now the most important thing above everything else is total amount of carbohydrate you're taking in at one time. The other thing to keep in mind, if you do have something like a sweet or dessert or pumpkin pie at the end of a meal, one of the good ways to do that is as soon as you have some protein with a high glycemic index carbohydrate or a carbohydrate that's high in these sugars that might turn to blood sugar quickly, then that decreases the effect of that glycemic index. So in other words, if you do have a small meal and you're having your dessert after that, say you have your turkey and you have some salad and you have a vegetable and a little bit of potatoes, and then you're having your pumpkin pie shortly after or with that meal, then the glycemic index is not anything we need to worry about, because as soon as you eat protein from the turkey with that, it totally changes how the body digests it. And so even though we've got these figures for different foods on how it affects blood sugar, as soon as you have nuts with something or anything with protein and little fat, that totally takes that basically outweighs anything related to the glycemic index.
Okay, very good. Well, we'll wrap things up now. And we do have this handout that Susan brought with this week, Diabetes-Friendly Holiday Season. And this will be in the Strawberry Fields newsletter, mm-hmm. which is out or will be out?
Yes, it's probably out today,
in the
actually.
Store? Okay. Mm-hmm. And if you're not in the neighborhood, as they say, mm-hmm. Drop us a line at the Afternoon Magazine, 300 North Goodwin Avenue, Urbana, Illinois, 61801. Send us a self-addressed stamped envelope, and we'll put this in the mail to you. And you don't have to be diabetic or pre-diabetic to enjoy these recipes.
That's
at
right.
all. They're good for all of us.
They're good for all of us. And there are a couple, I have a couple classes this week, too, that are free for anybody.
Oh, okay. Go ahead and mention those.
Okay. If they're interested, tomorrow at 12:15, I have a cookbook club that's at the ARC, the Activities and Recreation Center. And this one's the About.com Guide to Shortcut Cooking. It's just easy, fast cooking. That's at 12:15. And then on Wednesday, my student interns and I will be leading a free class on vegetarian cooking. So we'll be using seitan and tempeh and some different legumes. That's at 7 o'clock at the ARC Instructional Kitchen, and anyone is welcome to come to that. It'll be about an hour class where we'll be demoing and looking at some different recipes for vegetarianism.
Okay. Well, happy Thanksgiving.
Same to you.
We'll see
coming
you in
up.
December.
Okay.
Susan Kundrat of Nutrition on the Move.